So today, and I don't know, it's not Jyotish per se, but it's we could Jyotish per se, is that the right term? And you guys don't get the recordings of this kind of stuff online, but whenever I do conferences, I always love to practice on you know, you guys first, and you get to see what I'm lecturing on, and I get to practice. So it's a win-win, right? And now I have to find the screen share. OneNote. Here we are. All right. And how do I make it so it shows this big? Neither of you know.
No.
Good job.
There it is, right? One of these. Slideshow. Yay! Mm-hmm. So do you guys see the whole screen without the images, or are the images there?
With images.
With the pictures of you guys. Okay. And let's see. And if I wanted to start recording, stop video. What, is it automatically videoing? I guess it is. Oh, it wasn't supposed to automatically. Let's see, we stop. No, that's our video. Let's see, stop share. And then record. Record the cloud. All right. Then screen share. Yeah, we're rolling. So let's see. I'm going. Did I tell you guys who else is lecturing and all that kind of stuff? So you got the context. No. Okay. So let me. Did I give you like a list of some of the other lecturers? I can't remember what was level 2 and level 1 sometimes.
You didn't give us a list.
All right. So I'm just going to give you a quick list. That way you got an idea of who I'm talking to. So this is the 21st conference of psychology and Ayurveda that's held at the Maharshi University of Management in Fairfield, Iowa. And some of the other topics covered are Ayurvedic medicine and the unified field-based medicine, the microbiome and Ayurveda, how health of our gut determines the health of our mind, the Ayurvedic concept of Manovaha Shrotas and its disorders by Dr. Ladd. Maharishi's Yoga Asanas Are Life-Changing by some PhD researcher. The role of Pragna Parad in psychosomatic disorders from the perspective of Maharshi Ayurveda. Balanced brain, happy heart, how Ayurveda supports optimal mental health. Let's see. So you got the idea. Food and mood, exploring the connection between what we eat and how we feel. Psychology and Ayurveda and Vetha Thream, a comparative analysis. Journey from Tamas to Sattva, Ayurveda and post-traumatic stress disorder. Holistic psychiatry and the Sattvic Buddhi. Autism spectrum disorder and Ayurvedic management. Psychology and structuring dynamics of consciousness. And then me, I'll be lecturing on, it's titled, and you know, like, I don't like the title anymore. I liked it when I made it, but now it's like, but it's called Translating an Ayurvedic Integral Psychology. And And the big thing is I don't want to share with them what I wrote. It's like, I'm not going to give them all that. I want to give them just this. But then, like, my lecture, I wrote more. And so they're seeing, I wrote the Ayurvedic literature along with Jyotish, yoga, tantra, classical Indian music, and theater contain explicit and implicit psychological material and practices that reveal a complex, integral understanding of the mind and healing. There have been many attempts to integrate these concepts into Western psychology or translate Eastern concepts into Western psychological language, but the field of Western psychology is expanding and changing every decade. Modern psychology has multiple schools of thought and a new emerging field which is trying to integrate them. Present integral psychologies mix various Western techniques without a framework of mind or consciousness, and some even appropriate Vedic terminology for Western biomechanical concepts. And I'm referring to the integral psychology movement. And they do a horrible job at it too. Modern Ayurveda, as it is practiced in India, is already an integration of ancient wisdom and modern knowledge. This approach holds the potential to create a psychological infrastructure for modern day contradictory theories and research to be understood as working on different levels of the human being. By utilizing the Stula Sukshma and Karana Sharira with their associated anatomy, and a practical application of the Jagrat, Swapna, and Shushupti Avastas. Avastas. Oh, you guys. Ayurveda provides a truly holistic framework for an integral psychology that incorporates both ancient and modern science. Yeah, pretty cool, huh? So that's what people are expecting from me. All right. Let's see, how do I go next? All right. you know that first start, it's always the hardest because it's like, so what do you begin with? And so what I'm going to begin with is, I'm going to say there's no official Vedic psychology. No official Vedic psychology vidya. I don't know. Because everything in Sanskrit literature is taking into account psychological material. You know, you can't say where's Vedic psychology and pick up a book that's, it doesn't exist in the traditional material. Yet, I mean, what in Jyotish do we do that's not psychological? Mm-hmm. Everything is yoga, it's completely all about the mind. Everything, it's a whole culture focused on mind. So when you have a whole culture focused on mind, it's kind of almost like, you know, imagine in another culture that writes books on materialism, and they study materialism. Like in American culture, we would never write a book on materialism. It's just, that's our culture, you know? So Ayurveda, Manas Chikitsa, Yoga Chikitsa, Jyotish, Tantra, Natya Shastra, music, and especially grammar, all have psychology within them. Sanskrit literature started a revolution of thought in Europe. And when we look at history, we see that what European thought looked like before Sanskrit texts were being translated into European languages and what European thought looked like after, the whole modern psychological movement started with Buddhist and Vedantic literature being translated into Europe. They had no psychology either. It was only after that psychological research and understanding and thinking about thought started. All right, I got a time too. Philosophy and Chikitsa. So, you know, if there is no, like Manas Chikitsa, we can't say that's psychology because that's only treating a certain aspect of mind. And in Yoga Chikitsa, they're treating a different aspect of mind. In Jyotish, we're looking at another. We're looking at, like, personality and this kind of stuff. So there isn't an exact translation, and we can't use Manas Chikitsa. Modern psychology is more similar to what we could call Bhoktra Vidya. And Bhoktra means the experiencer. Like, what are you experiencing? You know, it's a study of like how we're experiencing, and it's on all these different levels. And from the Western perspective, they're, you know, as much as they understand the material sciences, they don't fully understand the experiencer yet. They're still trying to find out how the neurochemicals make it work, and you know, with nothing else. So there's a break of being able to get it there. It reminds me of the fact that the ancient Greeks, they believed that the planets moved in perfect circles. And because they moved in, broke their heads, they watched the planetary motions happen, and they tried to calculate how it worked, but like what they saw and their math never worked out. Because they said it has to be a perfect circle, it's the heavens. The heavens have to be perfect circles. They couldn't be ellipses. But if they had just let go of their concept of what perfect was, they would have been able to do the mathematics to realize it was an ellipse. So belief can sometimes stop you from understanding what's right there in front of you. And that means that makes the present task of Ayurveda to really bring out the psychological material that's already implicit in it in a more explicit way so that Western mind can understand it. What do you guys think of that slide? Good? Good. Yeah, yeah, good intro, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to begin with a little verse from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. And again, this has multiple levels because I'm going to be talking about prajna, and I'm also going to be talking about the underlying hidden psychology that's in everything Vedic. And in this verse, Janaka, he talks about, he learned about the importance of speech and how it's divine, and Yajnavalkya and you know, what is the support of speech? What is its foundation? And how do you attend to speech? And he said you attend to speech through as prajna. And prajna is often translated as intelligence, but we're gonna play with that translation. Janaka then says, what is prajna? And Yajnavalkya, he replies that it is speech itself. It is through speaking that we know a friend. Through speaking, we get to know somebody. So can we say that that's intelligence? Is it through intelligence that we get to know a friend? No, there's some, it's the intelligence doesn't hit it. But through prajna, we say, oh, I know you're my friend. You know, so there's something other than intelligence. It is through prajna that we know the four Vedas, history, mythology, science, Upanishads, mantras, aphorisms, explanations, the results of sacrifices, everything about this world and the world beyond, we know through speech. So here it's telling us that our whole world is created through speech. Everything we know and how we see the world is created through speech. This is a basic concept of the modern philosophy of structuralism and social constructionism. So, and it's this philosophy that influenced those modern schools of thought. And with that concept, it's the speech, it's how we talk, that influences how we perceive the world. The language that we speak in also changes how we perceive things. And so if we compare the concept of ego to ahankar, ego in English, and it's a Latin word that we use in English, it means I. In Latin it means I. And we talk about it as the concept, the I self in the person. And it's a noun. When you say ego, it's like you have this ego. It's like this thing, right? Mm-hmm. And it refers to a thing that can be located. You got scientists looking for where the ego is in the brain, and they're trying to find that structure that when it gets damaged, the ego doesn't exist anymore. And believing that it's a noun, it's creating a certain frame of perceiving. English in general is a noun-based language. And the awesome thing about noun-based languages is it's great for material science. It's great for the physical science. And because of that noun-based language, Western medicine on a material level has expanded. It's, you know, they know so much about the material world because they're thinking about it in noun language. Then we look at ahankara. And ahankara, it's I maker. It's a verbal root. So it's a functional concept. It's this thing making me have this individual sense of self. It's an action and a function. It's not a noun. It's not this thing that I find. It's a process that's happening. And so in general with Sanskrit language, we're looking at functional concepts. And in general, everything in the psyche is a functional process. It's something that's happening. And so when we talk about the Vedic perspective of psychology, we're not talking about nouns, we're talking about functions. We're talking about processes. So it's a very different way to look at the mind and a very different way to frame consciousness. So instead of trying to find memory in the mind, we're looking at the process of remembering. Instead of looking for an ego, we're looking at this process of making me an individual. So a very big difference in Sanskrit and English. And Sanskrit, from my belief, is much more adaptable to understand psychology. Like Latin is to the material sciences and Western physical medicine, Sanskrit has the potential to be in the psychological realm, because that's it's working on that psychological level innately. So language changes the way we look at things. It shapes our reality, and language can also make or break an idea. And this slide's not finished. So I gotta add some stuff still to it. But the concept here is there's a story of two different scientists. And one scientist, you know, when they discovered electricity, they were working with like dead things and electrocuting it. And they saw that when they electrocuted certain nerves, you know, like the finger would move. And so they were really beginning to understand the nervous system with electricity. And the first scientist, when he fully was doing the research, saw the nervous system working, and what he said is, this is how the soul communicates with the body. This is how our soul is getting its message across. And nobody really picked up on it. Then another scientist came along, looked at his research, did a little bit more, and he expanded it a little bit more, but not, you know, the root concept was already there. And he said, the nervous system is like a telegraph sending messages to the body. He's considered the founder of the person who discovered how the nervous system works. The guy talking about the soul communicating to the body, he didn't get any credit, like none. The only credit he gets is how, by framing things the wrong way, you don't get credit. So with that example, it's important how these Sanskrit terms of psychological material gets translated into English. Because literally, if we translate it the wrong way, it doesn't get heard. And if we translate it the right way, it can become the way things are. It can become a standard. But all of it is in the foundation of how we translate these words, how we bring these concepts into English. So when we look at how these Sanskrit words are brought into English, this is a little history of Sanskrit dictionaries. We got one, the first one was Sanskrit Portuguese, or Portuguese into Sanskrit, I should reverse that. In the 1720s, we had the first English one in 1819, then there was a really good German one, and they all played off of each other. They looked at who the other guy, how they translated it, and then they added some stuff and changed it a little bit, but they're all, like, when you look at them, you know, you can see where they copied and just added some stuff. And then we have I wrote 1970. That should be, Sir Monier Williams was 1870. So in 1870, we had Sir Monier Williams, and he's actually the primary dictionary that I use. And then we had in 1879, the Theosophical Society established itself in India. And the Theosophical Society is, you know, we look at them as very New Agey because of how they translated things. They translated things as if, you know, aliens were here to enlighten us or something. And so people didn't really pick up on it. And it's a complete translation issue because they did so many translations of Vedic texts that it's so wonderful that they did that, you know. There was more stuff translated into English during that time period than we've had since World War II. Since World War II, we've had like nothing compared to what was translated previous to that. And then we can see in 1882, William James joined the Theosophical Society. And in 1890, he wrote the first textbook on psychology in America. So 1890 was the first textbook on psychology. And it was very influenced by the Sanskrit, they call it the Sanskriti world. You know, all this Sanskrit literature that was coming into vogue during that time. And we think that the yoga movement's popular now. Sanskrit literature was more popular back in the late 1800s than it is now. And so we just have to reframe that. Just because it became unpopular after World War II doesn't mean it wasn't more popular back then. And they were doing Jyotish, some of these guys, these Englishmen back then. And so what did psychology look like at the time that they made these? And these are the dictionaries. These are the dictionaries that everybody uses. Still. This was the heyday of Sanskrit translations that most people are basing everything off of. And psychology during that time, the big scientific therapy was electrocuting people. Put on some electrodes and zap them until they forget. So they totally forget, I mean, they can completely forget people like, there's a story of a lawyer who got electroconvulsive and didn't remember any law anymore. You know, so it basically just destroys your brain so that you don't remember what you're sad about. And it works for certain things. Mesmerism is what they called hypnotherapy was pretty big back then, but it wasn't as good as electroconvulsive because you had to go to a doctor for electroconvulsive. The more traditional therapies were nature therapy and hydrotherapy. Hydrotherapy meaning like hot baths and soaks and going away on retreat. Those were the psychological treatments that were more natural and traditional. But the thing is, nature baths and nature walks and hot baths didn't make doctors money. So doctors were pushing for other things, where more techniques and things that they could apply like as medicines. In 1895, we have Sigmund Freud doing his studies in hysteria. In 1900, his interpretation of dreams, and talk therapy began. Before then, there wasn't even an understanding of the difference between, you know, like, is the brain just controlling everything? Like, an ego's in there, and your memory's in, like, it's all in the brain. Is it separate? Is it not? Like, there was no clarification on that. The level of psychology was relative to what we want to think it is. It was junk. So these Sanskrit translations of this really technical psychological information is not getting transmitted in the way they were translated. And they were translated with this Western concept of psychology at that time. So now here we have jnana, vijnana, and pragya. They're all translated as knowledge. They're all translated as thinking. They're all translated as knowing. And they're not differentiated. So because those guys didn't know how to differentiate them, there was no sense of differentiation. So in order to really get where I'm going, we want to retranslate these and take a deeper understanding of what these words mean. So the first is jnana, and jnana we can look at as rational knowledge. You can read it in a book, you know, somebody, you can learn it, it's just that simple concept of knowledge. We could almost translate it as knowledge that's information. The word vidya, jnana is vidya maya, it's made of vidya. Vidya, you know, from vidya, you're getting jnana. Vijnana is where we get more of a meta-knowledge. And this is special because I haven't seen anybody properly translate this. And if you get the translation that I'm about to give, you go back and look at all the texts, all of a sudden it's like, oh, so this is what they're trying to say here. This is how they're differentiating. The V in Vijnana has this concept of meta, meaning the thing about the thing. So meta-knowledge means knowledge about knowledge. It's this internally acquired, reflective process that's happening. So it's not just information that you read in a book, but it's something you had to think about, and you got this aha going on. And you noticed, a book might say, hey, when Mars is in the fourth house, it makes somebody argumentative. And you're gonna be like, okay, what's that mean? But then you read a few charts and you see how much those kind of people fight in relationships, and you go, that's what they mean by argumentative. They're not like always arguing, but in that realm, in that area, they fight with their spouse. So we get this more vijnana. It's like, you figured it out, you understood it. If somebody says, a massage feels good, like, a massage feels good. You can read in a book that a massage feels good, but you have to experience a massage, and then you're like, wow, this feels good. So that's vijnana. It's this more experiential knowledge that's gotten from you watching yourself. V means other than, apart, away from. So it's almost like you're not in the driver's seat, but you're looking at the driver's seat. There's a reflective nature to it. And meta is defined in English as a concept which is an abstraction behind another concept. So I like the term meta-knowledge, and meta-knowledge in different branches is used differently. But if we look at other words, we have vichara, which means reflection, vipassana. Vipassana means to discern, to distinguish, or to watch yourself, to watch what your mind is doing, right? Pasya means to look. Vipassana means to look at yourself, like what's happening. We have vimarsha, which is being aware of what's going on. So they all have these more meta internal processes. So this is vijnana, very different than jnana, right? And the dictionaries translate them the same. I mean, how crazy if we translate them the same if we want to understand a Vedic psychology. So then we have pragya, or prajna, as some people say it. Pra means before, in front of. And so sometimes people like to say, well, before, in front of, bigger than, better than, and they take it as up. You know, pra means up, because there's this Christian concept that God is up in heaven. And so bigger or higher than means up there, right? But pra in this sense is, and in a Vedic sense, pra is prior to. It's where things are originating from. So it's greater than, it's before, but it's actually deeper inside. And so the pragya, that knowledge that's before, is this deeper felt sense that's arising in the body. And I'm using the term felt sense because that's the term that the humanistic school of psychology uses. And when they say felt sense, you don't really know what it is yet. It's you meet somebody and you're like, I don't like this person. You don't know why you don't like them, but you just know. It's like, nah, this person, there's something wrong with them. And then other people you meet and you say, wow, I'm friends with them. They're my kind of people. And so if you remember in that Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, he said, what is pragya? And he said, it's how you know your friends. It's how you know someone is a friend. You get this feeling.
when we look, experiential psychology really goes into looking at how are you feeling? You know, something's coming up, you're talking about it, and they say, wait a minute. So what's going on in you? What are you feeling right now? And you sit there and you say, oh, my stomach has dropped, and I can feel my arm shaking when I talk about that. And so they start looking at this deeper communication that's coming up through your body that hasn't even reached consciousness yet. And so it's this deeper knowing. And so I'm in this sense, I'm using the term felt sense for prajna. But felt sense is not 100% right because it's that deeper knowing. All right. And now, if taking that translation of prajna, we have this concept of prajna parada. And everybody who's an Ayurvedic student here has heard that term before, right? What's it mean? What do they teach you that it means? Yeah.
Isn't that one of the causes of disease?
It's the number one cause of disease, and they translate it as
failure of the intellect.
Yeah. Failure of the intellect.
There you go.
So they throw that term intellect in there. Now, what we just understood about prajna, no way. It's not intellect. Intellect is almost like this information in your head. Like, okay, somebody told me not to eat apples and milk together because they don't mix, and I'm not listening. You know what I mean? It's a very head thing, in intellect. But when we take and we retranslate prajna as this inner felt sense, this deeper knowing of the body, and then, and aparada, it means fault, transgress, mistake, to offend. You know, it's like we're not listening to it. We're like, we're saying, nah, we're denying it. We're wrongly utilizing it. So when we take that felt sense and say this body, it knows, you know, it's like I pick up this and I'm like, oh, I shouldn't be having that, and I have it anyway. Like that not listening to that deeper felt sense that your body is trying to communicate. That's very different than mistake of the intellect, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Has a whole new meaning. So translation is so important for us to understand these deeper concepts. So I have 15 minutes left. They don't give me much time. It's
you're allotted just the 30 minutes.
I'm allotted 40 minutes plus, then I have to open it up for questions. And so it's a full hour, or it's, and then I 5 minutes for changeover or whatever, but yeah, so I gotta I'm good with time. I'm good with time. So now taking when I try to be, now taking that concept that we just looked at, and we look over into the realm of Western psychology, we see that they have that psychotherapy has competing modalities, and there's three main schools of psychotherapy. There's behavioral psychology, which is very biomechanical, and they do a lot with retraining samskaras, you know, like very Pavlovian dog reality. There's the psychodynamic school, which came about through Freud, and that's primarily talk therapies where you're trying to get insight and expressing these held back emotions. And then there's the humanistic school, which is person-centered. And they're all about trying to get where you're at. So what's going on with you? What do you got going on? Where are you not getting what you have going on? Like, you know, you feel really bad about something. The person is like, they really hate something. They're like, oh, I love going there. And it's very obvious that they don't. And they're like fighting and struggling. And so humanistic school is all about getting in touch with like what's really going on inside of you. Now, and then there's a common factors theory, which I don't want to go into, but it's very important to understand all of them within common factors theory. Now, these three schools, they've been fighting with each other for the last 100 years. And they all try and say that they're better. Their technique is better. And they have good reason to fight for why they're better, because, you know, that determines research funding, insurance reimbursement, all kinds of other benefits if their technique is right. Their school gets to have more students, the whole nine yards. So they all compete with who's got the better therapy. integration of these three schools started, and each of these schools has multiple different modalities. You know, all the different practices that are out there can be categorized under these three schools. And integration between them started in the 1960s when behavioral psychology and psychodynamic people started mixing that. And since then, there's been a handful of other ways to mix them. But one of the issues with mixing them is that they don't have any foundation to mix them. They're just like, oh, let's mix like this. Oh, let's take these techniques. Like, there's no, like, why? Why are you using, why are you mixing those techniques? Because those are the techniques the guy's trained in. Those are the techniques that, you know what I mean? They're mixing certain ones because that's the ones that they know. Not for some other kind of, you know, no science behind it. Now, in the world of integration that started since the 1960s? So since the 1960s, this concept of psychotherapy integration, of how do we mix these different therapies, there's three different schools of how to mix them. One is technical eclecticism. And it's, you know, sometimes use one technique, sometimes use another technique, and maybe we can find out which technique is better, and then we can just, like, use which one. And they all have totally different theories, but just who cares? Just, you know. Then there's theoretical integration, where we're trying to take different theories. Okay, he says it's repressed thoughts. He says that it's, you know, person's been trained wrong by their parents. Let's kind of integrate that, and they find some way to mix the theory. That way, you know, the techniques can be mixed around that. And then there's the assimilative integration, where they take that theory and they try and use the different techniques within a shared theory. Now, Ayurveda, if we looked at these, would fall under which?
So
Ayurveda falls under the assimilative paradigm. You know, Ayurveda, it has this root theory that when you understand that root theory, any technique, even pharmaceuticals, like, you know, when do we use antibiotics? There's a time to use antibiotics. When do we use operations? There's a time to use operations. Like, when do we use psychotherapy? There's a time to use psychotherapy. By understanding the human organism and understanding how everything functions, then we know when to use what. And so Ayurveda, based on that, has had this assimilative paradigm for a few thousand years. And part of that few thousand years, that ability to last so long was their ability to assimilate any new idea that came up. And so it's a well-seasoned assimilative paradigm. So if we look at psychotherapy integration with Ayurveda, if we use the Ayurvedic paradigm, and as I said, presently there's no agreed upon holistic approach. You know, there's how we mix them, and there's theories of how we mix them, but why mix them? Why mix those techniques? They don't have a reason of why to mix those techniques. Just that those are the techniques that are available. And some people, there's a concept called evidence-based therapy, where they're like, well, this therapy treats this condition better. But a lot of that evidence-based therapy, even though insurance companies are all about it, has basically been debunked, because any therapy is better than nothing. If somebody wants to kill themselves and you put them into a therapy, any type of therapy is going to help them get away from wanting to kill themselves. So statistically, any therapy is better than a placebo. And so doing evidence-based therapies, evidence-based is only about what therapies have the ability to afford those studies and to have manuals to go through all those studies. In the Vedic paradigm, there's a concept called darshana. And darshana means viewpoint. Based upon viewpoint, we take on different views. There's three levels of viewpoint. The physical, the mental, and the causal. And sometimes people translate the Karana Sharira as the spiritual body, and I really prefer to stay causal. Just going back to translation and how it has an impact, that causal has it's more true to the word, and it has more utilization throughout the modern paradigm than using the term spiritual. So physical, mental, and causal. That's from the physical perspective we're looking at that. When we take that into the realm of psychology, we're looking at the realm of jnana, the realm of vijnana, and the realm of pragya. So each of those, the jnana is relating to the physical realm. It's this dense aspect of knowledge. When we look at the vijnana, it's related to the sukshma, sharira, the mental realm of knowledge. And when we look at the pragya, we're looking at the causal. So when we're getting in touch with that deep sense of ourself, we're getting in touch with our causal nature. We're getting in touch with that which is causing us to do an action. So causal is way better than spiritual, because is it your spirit that's making you do an action? We saw what the guy who used the term soul with the nervous system got. It's, you know, we don't need to define it. There's something that's causing us to act. There's an urge that's causing us to act. And so the causal is giving us that deeper urge and that awareness of those deeper urges. All right. And that's as far as I got in my slide making. But basically, I go into the next little bit is... cognitive behavioral therapy is jnana, and so we gotta understand, like, when a person's not well, when they're depressed or when something's not functioning, was it jnana based? Was it something that they were trained in, and and thereby they're repeating just something they learned, and they need to break bad habits? You know, it's that just jnana based aspect of the mind that's not working. We got cognitive behavioral therapy. And when we enter the realm of psychodynamic, we're in the realm of vijnana. Is a person not, you know, there's something going on in them and they're not interpreting it correctly. There's parts of themselves they don't want to touch, they don't want to go into, they don't want to reflect upon, they're not looking at. We have the realm of vijnana. They're hiding from a past trauma earlier in life, and they're just not, they're like, I'm not looking at that. We know we're in the realm of vijnana. And when we enter the realm of humanistic psychology, they're trying to get what's going on with the person. There's this deeper, I want to get what's going on. What's your deeper impulse for life? So they're really trying to get what's the causal, what's going on a causal level? What's causing a person? And how do we get them in line to their cause? See why causal is so much better than spiritual? And because that's, karna means to make, to cause. So karna sharira, that causal space, it's a way better translation. So this right here is an Ayurvedic approach to integrative psychology. And it's a conscious way of looking at how we can mix these. One of the issues we run across is in a large amount of the psychodynamic literature, they really don't differentiate the sukshma and the karana sharira. The vijnana and the prajna is not differentiated. When we get to the humanistic side, they only focus on the prajna. So we don't have to really worry about that mix-up happening. But with that lack of differentiation happening on the psychodynamic level, it creates a bit of confusion. Okay, now I need a good conclusion.
Right.
So we see how language can completely change our idea of a concept, And thereby, when we look at these sciences and all these psychologies that are coming up, they're coming up by watching what's going on and seeing where somebody's not working and trying to heal a person at that level. So what is natural will always be revealed. And these three schools of psychology, it's no surprise that there's three schools, right? Because they're working on these three aspects of what's going on inside of our heads. And being able to clearly distinguish which of those areas we have an issue, thereby employing or sending a person to the right type of therapist, is going to assure a more successful therapy. All right.
Say again.
The bathroom.
Okay. All right. Key right there. It's just like it used to be, but upstairs instead of downstairs. All right. Any comments?
I like how you broke down the ego and with the noun versus like the action. That really made sense to me.
I felt like there was I needed more transition from where the previous slide to that.
Was that the dictionaries or something? The
dictionaries was after it. Yeah. I felt that was a little rough going. We talked about how language shapes a reality. Okay. And then I went right into ego and ahankara.
But that makes sense because you did talk about how like English is a more noun language and then Sanskrit's a more functional.
And it's changing how we look at them. Yeah. I think I got to just bring that concept that looking at things as nouns versus looking at things as verbs is shaping our reality very differently.
Yeah.
So I just got to stress that point and, or weave that in there somehow.
Yeah.
Or maybe give it as a conclusion on the bottom. You think the dictionary, was there too much with the dictionaries, or was that wasn't too much, right? Mm-hmm. Giving the history of Sanskrit dictionaries?
That's appropriate. I mean, the audience there though is pretty knowledgeable. Well, do they know that?
I doubt they would know that. I would doubt they know that. So you know, I mean, you don't know that. They're Ayurvedic, they're people who practice Ayurveda, just, you know, like you. Like, you don't learn that in Ayurveda school, the history of Sanskrit dictionaries. So... what do you think, Dan?
Yeah, I think maybe the dictionary part was a little bit more than you needed.
Should I leave it there and just talk less about it?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe leave it there and talk less about it. The end seemed a little rushed.
Yeah. But that's how first time through, you know, you're kind of balancing out, like, how much everything is going to take.
I think you should keep it there, and the reason being that if you're giving a lecture on this, they should know where your definitions are arising and why they might see something different.
Yeah.
It's important to see the history unfold.
And I can just have everybody look at the fact that they're all in the 1800s. So all the Sanskrit dictionaries are more than 100 years old. Some of them 130, 140, 150 years old. You know, it's also, you know, when I talked about the electroconvulsive, and I mean, there's still people that practice that these days. So it's really tough to really talk about how barbaric it is, you know, but
still
like
being practiced.
That it's still being practiced, even though it's that barbaric. And it's only being still practiced because they don't have anything else to do instead. Those type of you know, doctors. What did you think about the implications of Prajnaparada? Like, everybody there is going to know Prajna Parad. They've all learned it in Ayurveda school. Did you have a, like, wow, that's a whole different way I thought about it?
I did. It was like, I mean, you kind of get the sense of it, of that being the innate body wisdom, but it's not really how I learned it. So it was nice. I like that, yeah.
To make it clear, right? It's like, yes, that's what it is. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. And competing psychotherapy modalities, I think I gave enough information in that realm. Yay. It'll be a good lecture. All right. So, Ian. See, if we were live, we could all just take a break and stand up and get a drink real fast. Maybe let's just take a 2-minute break just for transition's sake.
Sounds good.
And then we'll start on page 177.
Sure.
So I'm not going to expect you guys to memorize Shadbala, but you have to know what Shadbala is and what it's composed of on a general level. That way when it says, look at Shadbala, it's not like, what's Shadbala? You're like, oh, it's that thing that's composed of this and that and that and that. Later, you can go deeper into it and expand it and all that. It's incredible depth. But for right now, you just have to know what it is and where this concept is coming from. And then Once Ian's done, we'll do a few charts like we did last time.
All right. Just to let you guys know, my roommate has some people over, so if you hear noise in the background, that's what it is. Otherwise, we'll start. So if you could turn to page 177. So the idea around... So we've talked about the idea of strength regarding the planets and what capacity they can work, and now we're looking at how houses function as far as rules of strength and status go. So there are these ideas listed here of when a house prospers, and some of the stuff is easy to understand. And some of it takes a little bit more deeper thought to look at. But for a house to prosper, one of the main things is if it's occupied or aspected by benefics. And that's fairly straightforward. I think the idea of planets that are beneficial or helpful in general are going to give strength to or aid the house in performing its functions. So, you know, say, let's say the 10th house has benefics either occupying or aspecting it. What that will do is that will give greater either opportunities or ease around the work environment or one's artha. I guess in a more easier capacity to understand this idea around relationships, if we're looking at the 7th house and we see that there are benefics there or that there are benefics aspecting, that will cause a relationship to prosper or the area of relationships in that person's life to prosper. On the other hand, we see this the house will be unsuccessful when its lord is destroyed or conjunct malefics. Or if it's not aspected by its own lord or benefics. So we see that there's this quality of, if there are benefics causing aspect or occupying it, it's helping, and if there aren't, there's a quality of it not functioning as well. Does that make sense? So then the second part of that prospering is if the house is aspected by its own lord. And the idea being that the lord of that house is then tending to the house. So, you know, if the lord of the ninth house is in the ninth house, then there's this quality of the guru being present, of there being this kind of unfoldment of that ninth house reality taking place. The house will be unsuccessful when it's in combination with the Dustana lords. So do we remember which houses are Dustanas?
6, 8, and 12.
Great. So there's this idea that those houses cause loss or arguments or difficulties, and the idea being that if that lord is then placed, so let's say the eighth house lord is placed in the ninth, we could say that there might be difficulties in a person keeping or maintaining a particular tradition or studying a particular path. Let's say, you know, from a level of higher education, the person might be changing majors a lot, or something in the way that the transformation of that ninth house as it's occurring is making it difficult for them to stay on a trajectory to dive deeper into their education or into their spiritual experience. Does that make sense?
Would that apply if it shares a lord with a Dustana house as well?
You mean, so like, let's say Capricorn is in the 8th house and then Aquarius is in the 11th, or sorry, is in the 9th house?
Sure, and then, and so then with the 9th house...
That would be different in that the lord of that house would be then, so let's say Saturn is placed in the 9th house, and it is a Dustana, it's going to carry qualities of the Dustana from it being the lord of the 8th house as well. But it is also the lord of that house, so in some ways it prospers, and yet there's also a quality of difficulty, also just the nature of Saturn.
Okay.
So there's a nuance to it. But yeah, the general rule though is that if there are Dustanas occupying or giving aspect to the lord, they can cause issues around that. Let's see, and then we have this idea of when the lord of the house is in the 10th house. And if you remember, when we're looking at a chart, the 10th house is the high point, the zenith of the sky. So it's the idea of that lord. So if, let's say, the 4th house lord is in the 10th, one, it's aspecting its own house, and two, it's at the highest point in the sky, which is this kind of its own level of strength that it's become prominent. It's like the noonday sun. Does that make sense? The idea of when the lord of the house is in a good avasta, if we look at like the conditions of it, if the lord of the house is ucha, and there's a sense of excitement, and it's able to kind of perform at its best or function well, then the house is going to function well. So if the lord is happy, then the house is happy. And looking again at the combination with the Dusana lords, then we have this losing a planetary war. And when we had talked about this is an application to the lord of that house. So if the lord of the house loses the planetary war, it becomes unhappy. And if it's a benefic, it becomes weak. And if it's a malefic, it becomes angry. And it's still weak, but it will weaken the strength of the house as well, that the houses as well that it rules. So just something to just be aware of is that the Lord of the House carries all the significations of that house with it. So when we see it moving to another house or interacting with another planet, we can start to infer more about what that house means. So not only, you know, if Mercury rules the fourth house, not only is Mercury going to represent the intellect, acquisition of skills, all of these things, it's also going to represent the house, happiness, the mother, that sort of thing. So we now see that these planets carry much more. And so when the Lord is impacted, then the house is, also gets impacted.
Let's say, I have this, so Venus losing a planetary where we talked about that last week, but it's in the 10th house. So the houses that it's the Lord of is like one of those stronger than the other because it's in the 10th, but it's also...
Yeah, let me pull your chart up. All right, so Venus is in a war with Rahu, correct?
Right.
All right, and it loses the war. That would indicate that, so Venus is the Lord of the 11th house and the 4th house. So what we see here is that there's a weakening because of that. On the other hand, it's in the 10th house, so we see that there's an exchange of power going on here. So it's not completely devastating if it wasn't in the 10th, but it is being impacted by the fact that it's lost a war. So there is a weakening that's occurring, and it's not able to give as full of results as it would give if it was not in that planetary war and in the 10th house.
Okay, so they kind of cancel each other out, but not completely...
Right, there's a nuance there. So
sure. We
would say that there's Venus, anything in the 10th house, and again, anything in the Kendras is going to become absolutely important for that person in their life. So in this case, looking at Venus and everything related to Venus, Venus is going to play an important role. And when you see... So the idea being that the planets within the Kendras give direction to the person's life. And when you see that Venus is impacted in this way, it's going to still make that an important part of the person's life, but you might see difficulties around it, like things just kind of not lining up as well, or like the strength of it just being a little less than desired.
Okay.
So then we have this idea of if it's in a bad avastha, then it's going to also bring destruction's a heavy word to use, but it's going to bring a negative bent to the houses because the planet isn't in a good condition. And it's, you know, same idea of like, is it exalted? Is it debilitated? This idea of is it asleep? Is it able to function at its best capacity, or at a good, you know, at a good capacity if we're looking at this grayscale? Let's see. Any questions on that part? So something down here, the second.
Yeah, can you hear me? Am I on?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay.
So, if you look at the second paragraph and you see that the fourth house is...
I just got on, so I just... Sorry.
Okay, great. So if you look at the second paragraph and see the... this is below the bullet point. For example, the fourth house is the house of happiness. If Mercury, so this is the idea of how benefics are helping, if they're aspecting or conjunct. Jupiter and Mercury So if Mercury aspects, one has the skills to work on themselves to attain a happy state of feeling. And this is for the fourth house. While Jupiter's aspect gives the person the resources to attain happiness, yet if Saturn is aspecting, the person is lacking something and will experience some suffering. So these are ideas that, just in general, when we're looking at if something's going well or not going well, we just see biplanetary interaction in kind of a basic nature of what that planet is. Is it a malefic? Is it a benefic? You know, if Venus is there, there's going to be a greater sense of smoothness around it, and desire and attractiveness to that house. Let's see. Can I have? I think I'll have Dan read this second page on page 178. Just the let's see. Just the first two paragraphs, please.
The next thing to notice is that Parashva says houses are good if their lord is in the tenth, and destroyed if combined with Pistana lords. This shows that planets need to be seen not only according to their natural significations, but also according to their house lordships, as well as their placement. First, see where the lord of a house has gone. If the lord has gone to a positive house, like the tenth or ninth, then it makes the house strong. If the house lord has gone to a negative house, like the sixth or eighth, then it damages the house. There are two differentiations to make here, the placement from the lagna and the placement from the sign itself.
So that adds a layer of complexity, right? We're currently just looking at things from the lagna, and yet now we're looking at if things are placed from the sign itself, that it's of the house that it's lording. So let's look back at the chart. Let me bring it back. Sorry, I accidentally closed it. And here's the thing with Jyotish too, is that we're constantly looking at things from different vantage points. Oftentimes we'll look at a chart from the perspective of the moon, and sometimes from the sun itself. This is something that's kind of interesting, and it takes a while to get used to, is looking at the chart from so many different perspectives.
Ian, why would we choose one or the other, the sun or the moon, as a vantage point?
Well, one of the perspectives is that the moon is the mind, or manas, and everything that we perceive in the world is going to be impacted by, or everything that we experience in the world is going to be impacted by our mind. So we can look at things from the level of the mind and see how the world is influenced, or is how we perceive, or how the person whose chart you're reading is perceiving the world, versus a more, for lack of a better word, a more objective reality that we see from the ascendant. And then from the sun, we would see more of a soul level understanding of things. So that's the general, those are the general reasons for why we look at those three different perspectives. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Is it kind of a something that you do with every client? Like you know, you just kind of get a look out from all three angles?
Yeah, definitely. I tend to look a little less at the sun for that, but the moon is very important. And when we start to cover nakshatras and we see how the nakshatras really give the lens through which that person views the world, that colors the rest of the reading. So even if you decide that you're not going to look at the chart from the moon's perspective, just having that knowledge is going to drastically alter how you interpret things for that person. You know, So, like, it gives a level of subjectivity that, say, you know, if someone had the same chart as Caroline here, except for the moon was in a different location, they might experience the world, you know, have the same things present themselves to the person, but perceive it completely differently. You know, like, sometimes we have meetings with friends or business meetings or whatever, and we all saw the same stuff, but did we perceive it and experience it the same way? Usually not. Someone might perceive something as funny versus someone might find it sad, those sorts of things. So that's how we start to see this, a greater nuance, you know. Yeah. Does that explain a bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. So when we're looking, let's say, let's go with this Venus example. So Venus is in the 10th house, and we're looking at it from, if it's lost the planetary war, that's kind of unfortunate. We can't do anything about that from the change of perspective, looking at the signs. But what we can see is, it rules the second house, or sorry, it rules the 11th house, and so it's gone from the 11th all the way around to the 12th house from it. And that placement is typically not seen as the best placement, because it's in a place of expenditures and loss from that house. So the 11th house is losing something, or is expending a lot of energy in career, or you know, kind of just general things regarding the 10th house. But if we look at, say, from the 4th house, it's gone to the 7th from it, and 7th house is a reasonable house to be in. So we can see, just in general, like, this is a better placement for the fourth house than it is for the 11th house. So the fourth house prospers a little bit more than the 11th house does, just from, you know, if we're not looking at anything else, just from this alone, we see that the fourth house does better. Does that make sense? All right, and
I guess I'm a little confused. So, like, for example, her chart, you're looking at Venus and where Taurus and Libra have gone, but I thought you're supposed to look at where the Lord of the 10th house has gone. So it's Aries. Wouldn't you look to see where Mars went?
Let's see. So it says, first we see where the Lord of a house has gone. If the Lord has gone to a positive house, like the 10th or the 9th, it makes the house strong. If the house Lord has gone to a negative house, blah, blah, blah. The placement here is from the lagna, the placement from the sign itself. So it's really, it is just all of the houses we are looking at this, and the planets on an individual basis. And in this case, he's just referencing that the 9th and 10th house are great placements. And you can, as a general rule, you can look at this and say that if it's gone to a Kona from it, or if it's gone to a Kendra from it, those are great placements for it. And that 10th in this case has a role of being, of making the house prosper. 10th from that house makes it prosper.
So the fact that her Mars, which owns the 10th house, is in the 9th from it, in the 6th, it's in a Kona from it. So that would actually help the 10th house, even
yes,
though Mars
yes.
is in the 10th? Okay.
And the other thing too, though, is we still take into account that it's in the 6th house, which on a different level, there's the ability for Caroline to be able to stand up for herself when arguments or fights come up because of that Mars placement there. Does that make sense? Because we have that malefic quality within the 6th house, the person won't be a pushover. So
that's kind of looking at it from the ascendant, right? From the ascendant within the 6th house. But then how do you apply that Kona rule? Because the ruler is in the 9th from the 10th, you know, the ninth house. So then how would that apply?
Yeah, so first off, we don't negate what we're seeing with the ascendant placement. We're looking at multiple layers here. So we have the ascendant placement. Mars is in the sixth house. That alone isn't seen as necessarily a positive. However, if we're looking at the planet itself, because Mars rules two different houses, in this case, we have Mars is ruling the fifth house because Scorpio is there, and we have Mars also ruling the 10th house. So sixth house general, it's not going to be the best for those houses. But we also look at it's gone from the 9th, for the 10th, and then it's gone from the 5th house to, so if we're looking at Scorpio, it's gone one house over, and 2nd house placement isn't the best. So we can see that there's nuance here in that the 10th house is doing better from this rule.
To differentiate, though, when we're doing the house from, like, for example, if we do fourth lord from the lugna is your relationship to mother and properties. When we do the where the fourth lord's gone from the fourth lord, we're looking at your mother's, how strong your mother is and how your, you know, what's going on with the properties. We're referring to the strength of that thing versus your relationship to that thing. Just to be clear. So if
from the lugna, it's your relationship to the home or whatever house, and from the house, it's the house's relationship.
It's the house's nature.
Okay.
Like, for example, if the fourth lord has gone, I have the fourth lord in the 8th. So it shows, you know, fourth lord in the 11th. And so with the fourth lord, and can you just click on whatever the right there it is, says Bavat Bavam. A little bit. We're using Bavat Bavam. We're using basically the rules of Bavat Bavam. Fourth from the fourth. It's not really Bavat Bavam. Because Bavat Bavam would be, and so I'll come to Bavat Bavam when I'm done the example. So for me, I have fourth lord in the 11th. So fourth lord in the 11th means I make lots of money off of property. And I always, you know, like in, let's see, 2005, so that's how long ago? 17 years? No. How long is that? So 12 years ago. So 12 years ago, I bought a house, and I've been a landlord since, and oh my gosh, it's made life so easy, you know, like, and to show that I bought two properties and fixed them up a little bit and sold them, and like, wow, I made more money doing that than anything else in my life so far. One property I fixed up a little bit and I sold for double the price I got it for, you know. That's my fourth lord in the 11th. Now my fourth lord being the 11th, that's 8th from the 4th. So what do you think? So my mother, she was a nurse when I was a little kid, and you know, like her and I, we have a tough relationship. I have a cursed moon, and the moon's 8th from it, so we have a tough relationship, my mother and I, and you know, she's 8th house. It shows somebody who doesn't know where to apply themselves. My mother doesn't know where to apply herself. She does a bunch of stuff, but like, there's no real direction. She runs her yoga studio and talks about a million things and doesn't do anything. And so you got the difference between me and my relationship to the fourth versus how the fourth is doing as itself. Now, Bavat Bavam would be fourth from the fourth is the grandmother. So it's looking at the seventh house as grandmother. So it's slightly different. You know, we're looking at houses from the houses, not the lords from the houses.
So, just to be clear, this is in the following paragraph. I'm just saying that freedom, what you just said, is exactly what's in the following paragraph.
Okay.
So it makes it easier for the students to see that we hadn't gotten there yet. This is stuff that you can look over, and definitely, I think, freedom talking about it helps to elucidate it better. But the general ideas of why we're looking at this from multiple perspectives of both the ascendant and then from the house itself or the sign itself, that this gives an excellent example of why. So the third part of this is so the third factor Parashara teaches is to be aware of the avastha of the Lord. The state the house lord is in will show how we feel when that house gets activated. If the fourth lord is exalted, we will feel dipta or excited when we are at home. If the tenth lord is combust, the sun, we will feel kopa when we are or angry when we are at work. If the lord of the upapada, which is something you will learn later, the marriage point, is in an enemy sign, the person will feel dirtied when they get married. In this way, the avastas are factored into making a house strong and weak. So if we can think of the houses as different parts of life, this is also showing how we experience those parts of life. Does that make sense? So this is why knowing the strengths and understanding these basic principles of is a planet awake or not, is it happy, is it sad, is it angry, all of those things, that's how this starts to become important. So Parashara also mentions planet losing a planetary war destroys the house at Lords. This is also understood in any negative combination like Gandanta, Sandhi, etc. that damages the planet. That which damages the planet will also damage the house at Lords. So we had talked about that earlier, these in the general placement of success and failure of a house.
Did we go over, I just joined, so I'm sorry if I missed some things. Did we go over what I think was just read before about if the house's lord is in a Dushtana house, where was that? That it shows, for example, the sixth lord is hurting a house, the house it is placed in. So it's the sixth lord. If the sixth or eighth house lord is in that house, it hurts that house. Not if, let's say, in the fourth house lord is in the eighth house. It doesn't work both ways, or does it?
Oh, there's a quality of. So there's a quality of the sixth house being, if we're looking at, let's say the 10th house, and the lord of the 10th house is in the 6th, or it's with the 6th house lord, that is going to cause, and if you look at that first page, which I don't know that you were here for it, on page 177, if we look at the unsuccessful, one of the basic things is that if the lord of that house is destroyed or conjunct and malefic, if it's in combination with Dushtana lords as well, that gives issue. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, so maybe just reread this part.
And also, if the lord of that house is in a Dushtana house, correct? I don't see
correct.
It written here, but I would assume that that is also correct.
That is also correct, yeah.
Okay.
So, and that's something we talked about also, is that if it's gone to the ninth or the 10th house, those are beneficial placements. But if it's gone to, say, the 6th house, the 8th house, or the 12th house, then those are seen as fairly problematic because of the Dushtana quality.
Okay. I think I might have to move my study area because I think I'm disturbing people here at the retreat, so.
Sure, you wouldn't mind just putting us on mute.
Okay.
So, with the Shadbala, Any more questions for Soph?
I wouldn't mind seeing some more examples of how to stack all these things. It's starting to feel like spinning plates.
Freedom said we're going to do that at the end.
Thanks. We don't have to do double time with it. So let's look at Shadbala if there aren't any more questions on this part. So Shadbala is a way of calculating particular strengths of the planets. What we're looking at, just a quick glance through, we can see that there are these different ideas. So there's positional strength, which is Sthana Bala, and that's broken down into exaltation strength, then the strength born from the seven Vargas, which we're kind of going to skip over because that's something that Freedom is going to discuss later when we get to the Varga chapter. If it's in an even sign or odd sign strength, angular strength, which if it's in a Kendra, then Drekana Bala, which is the third division strength, and we're looking at, again, placement of female versus male. This is all stuff we'll look at a little more in depth, but I'm just going over quickly. So we have all of this under positional strength, just this general idea of these are different things that we're looking at. The second part to it is, so Shad is six, so we're looking at six different calculations of strength here. So Mbala is strength. So these are six strengths. So then the second one is Digbala, and Digbala is directional strength. And this is something that becomes fairly easy to glance at and something I recommend looking at and memorizing here. Even though we're not necessarily memorizing everything else, Digbala becomes very important. So in general, you'll see like the moon has its strength in the fourth house. Venus has its strength in the fourth house as well. And those are Karakas of that house. We also have the sun and Mars at its directional strength when it's in the 10th house. And if you think about the sun's position being in the 10th house, that's when it's functioning the best from our perspective. It's up right above us. It's giving as much life as possible at that point. Then we have Saturn and Rahu, and they get their strength in the 7th house. And you can see a similarity between Saturn becoming exalted in Libra. Do you notice that? That if Saturn's moved to the seventh sign, it has this quality of exaltation or of strength that's there. So that's the same for the house placement. It gives it an added strength. If we see Jupiter or Mercury with both have to do with the intellect and where the intelligence is going and where the ability to apply oneself is, if that's in the first house, which is the house of self, that greatly benefits the person's chart. Does that make sense? So these are things to look at, and they're just helpful. I think that it becomes easier over time as you're looking at charts. You'll just start to see like, oh, someone who, let's see, like in Dan's chart, he has Mercury and Jupiter in the first house, so you can see that there's that strength that's there. We can see that whatever Jupiter and Mercury are representing in that chart, there's going to be a highlighted quality because of that.
Highlighted how?
Oh, in that the Karaka, whatever that Mercury is representing in your chart. So let's say, what this does is it gives strength to that planet. So if we're looking at Shadbala as just planetary strength and it's going to its placement. So let me pull up the shared screen. So I just happened to notice that because you were talking about you had asked something earlier, and I wanted to look at your chart to see as an example. But we have here Saturn has gone to the seventh house, and that is Digbahala. That's one of the directional strengths. So we know that Saturn has an extra strength that's calculated here. We have Mercury and Jupiter, and they have gone to the first house. So what that's going to do is give strength for that planet and increase its sort of its level of importance and like raise it up a little. So let's say like the other planets, every planet has a different way of functioning. Those planets that are in Digbahala are going to have this like slight increase in their strength and ability to function within the chart. So if we say, in other parts of Shadbala, if we have a lot of, like, if the moon is considerably weak, we could say that the moon's ability to function in that person's life is just not really, it's not as strong, and it's not going to deliver as good of results and be as dependable. Does that make sense? So these are things to just factor in a little bit more. So then we have this idea of strength accorded by time. And so you should just generally know that there are planets that are considered stronger at night and planets that are considered stronger during the day. And this freedom's just wanting you to know this in general, but this is something that becomes more important it becomes more important during the use of Prashna or casting a horary chart, so a chart for the question at that moment, some of what we had talked about last week. And the idea is just that there are planets that are said to gain strength during the day, such as Sun, Jupiter, and Venus, and then there are planets such as Moon, Mars, and Saturn that get stronger at night or closer to the zenith. Another thing to look at is this concept of waxing and waning strength. So in this section of strengths, what we're looking at for Pakshabala, is that when the moon is waxing, the benefics become strong. And when the moon is waning, malefics become stronger. So if you think of the idea of, we've talked about the devas and the asuras, and asuras being without light, ultimately, there's this quality of a gaining in light and moving towards the full moon, or the fullness of the moon, which has a greater amount of light that's going to have be a better time for the benefic planets that are trying to help you versus the malefic planets that, as that light is decreasing, the malefics are said to have a stronger hold. Does that make sense? So again, this is not stuff to really memorize. This is a general principle. Some interesting ideas here. So we also have this idea of, the Tribhaga, three-part strength. If the 12-hour day or the 12-hour night is divided into 4-hour sections, it is then 3 sections called Tribhaga. Each planet gets strength in a particular third, while Jupiter always has full Tribhaga strength of 60 points. So this is, again, I guess something I hadn't mentioned is that each aspect here, you're giving an addition of points to see what's accruing in the chart as far as which planet's gaining strength. And we can look on the software program, we can look through the strengths section here, and we can see, so clicking from, we were looking at basics to moving over to strengths, we can see a general calculation here, and this is not 100% accurate because there's nuance, of course, but this is a general idea to see which planets are stronger overall, looking at just Shambhala. So in this case, this is showing that sun is at 188 points, which as it being so high is going to have a large impact from just this level alone is going to deliver the most results because of that strength. Alright. So then there's this other section of, oh, did someone have a question?
Yeah, there's, I'm confused because it says the full, this full Tribhaga strength of 60 points, but then in this, in his Shardala chart, the sun is 188, so.
Why the discrepancy? So what this is indicating, Shardala is the, this is the percentage of strength or the number, total numbers of strength given for all of these different calculations. Mm. Not okay. Just, yeah. So that's, this is, each little thing, the reason why we're kind of going over this is just each little thing is giving an added piece of strength. If there's something that's there, it's gaining a little more strength, showing that that planet has a little more power. So all of these things have to be taken into consideration. However, as we can see, so like here's, this is the third pillar here, which is strength accorded by time. We can see that there are four different sections here that we're looking at. So we can look at day-night strength, we can look at waxing, waning strength, we can look at three-part strength, or this year, month, day, lord strength. Those are a smaller piece of that one pillar of strength. However, we look over at Digbala and that's a whole pillar of strength is accorded to just the directional placement. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but how do we get the calculation of how many points we attribute to it?
So you can look at, if you go back and read the from page 179 down through and just go more carefully through it, you can see all the different points. These are general ways, but that's not something that we're needing for the class. Freedom just wants a general introduction for you to see this. We actually have a whole section of strengths that are much more easy and applicable for reading charts that we'll be getting to shortly. But this is classical stuff, and you will see this if you start to read other books on astrology or interface with Vedic astrologers. This is stuff that they talk about, so it's good to have a general understanding. So we have, let's move on to natural strength. So we have natural strength here is the fourth pillar. So we have the natural strengths of planets are constant in all charts. It shows which planets will be able to more naturally give their results. If two planets have the same Shardala, this will be the determining factor. The Sun is the strongest with 60 points, Moon has 51 points, Venus has 43 points, Jupiter has 34 points, Mercury has 26 points, Mars has 17 points, and Saturn only gets 9 points. So we can see that each planet is going to have a different level of strength that it's coming in with. And Saturn, if Sun is the strongest, Sun is going to be the life force, versus Saturn on the opposite end is going to be the old man, that crippled quality. So these are ways to just think of like, there's a distinction in the movement from our own perspective, like what's bigger in the sky as being what's going to have more points allotted to it already. So it's kind of like if you were to consider, and this is maybe not the best association, but like in golf or other games where there are these handicaps, there's like a level at which you're already starting at and in which you're engaging. And this is a way to see like the Sun is already going to have more strength than Saturn is allotted to it. And then everything else is going to get weighed in on top of that. Does that make sense? All right, and then this other part where we're talking about retrogradation. we have, I'll have Sarah, if you don't mind reading this paragraph under Cheshtavala, the emotional strength.
Sure. The emotion, Cheshta, strength, shows the power of the desire of a planet. It shows how much strength it has for what it wants. This shows which planets desires will lead us more. The Cheshtavala of the sun is the same as its Ayanabala. It is stronger in the northern course, spring to fall, and weaker in the southern course, fall to spring. The Cheshtavala of the moon is the same as the Pakshabala. It is stronger in the waxing phase and weaker in the waning phase.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So we can look at these different things here, and we have different points associated with different stations in which the planets are moving. So if a planet is retrograde, it's given the highest number of points allotted for that section, which means that if we look at a chart and we see the parentheses around that planet, we know that it's retrograde. Automatically, that's going to become an important planet for that chart. And in this case, retrograde, as we see in this this little paragraph here, it says the other planets are in one of eight motions that a planet is capable of. So the sun and the moon never go retrograde, just to put that out there. The most important aspect is to see that a retrograde planet become very strong relative to desire. A retrograde planet will have a very strong desire for the aspects of life it significates naturally. So if we're looking at this chart above it, it's a little more parsed out as to what it's meaning. But if we looked at if Dan's on, we have Dan's up here in Saturn. So if a planet is retrograding and it's going so far back that it's ending up in the next sign, that's given a different number of points versus if it's just gone retrograde. So there's retrograde, which is 60, and then 30 points would be the points allotted to it retrograding into another sign. Then there's this idea of things moving. If the planet is moving slower than its average, and if it's moving even slower than before, but it's not gone into retrograde, and it's possibly moving from a direct motion to just starting to slow before it's going to go back, that's what we're talking about. And
Ian,
then
how can you tell, looking at Dan's chart, if it's just gone into retrograde or if it's been in retrograde for a while? Where can you tell that?
Well, we know how long a planet's going to be able to move from the planet section, where we've talked about how many days it takes for a planet to move into a different sign. In this case, we can make a good assumption because it's at 11 Capricorn, that it's pretty far in there, that if it started going retrograde, there's no way that it would have been going retrograde from Aquarius to 11 degrees. And it wouldn't go from, it's, you know, if we're catching it at this point, that it wouldn't even be considered.
I understand.
Great. There are these different ideas, but the big thing to point out here is that retrograde increases the desires of that planet and the strength of that desire. So, a lot of questions earlier on were asked about the qualities of retrograde. This is what we're looking at here, is when a planet becomes retrograde, there's a greater desire for whatever that is to manifest. So kind of a different way of looking at Mercury in retrograde is, from the Western perspective, people say that communication becomes difficult during this time, that sort of thing. Well, that's possible, but what's really becoming important is the ability to speak or to perform actions. And so we see that something, it's going back because there's one way of interpreting it as something hasn't been done yet, or it has to be revisited. but more specifically from this perspective, we're looking at it as it has so much desire that that's becoming this focus point. You know, so then we start to see how Mercury playing out in someone's chart, if Mercury's in retrograde and it's in a location that might be signifying instruction, that person is going to have strong desires to learn or to gather information as an information gatherer versus like a retrograde Jupiter where there might be this strong and deep yearning for spiritual teachings. Does that make sense? Okay. So then we have this whole section here of Shatbala of the houses. And we've talked a little bit about this. There's an idea of certain signs that are, let me start at the beginning of this. So Prashara mentions that mathematical strengths can also be calculated for the houses. This can be then graphed as well. Malefics subtract points from a house and benefics add points. Jupiter and Mercury add full points to a house showing their beneficence in aspect. Jupiter and Mars and the Sun subtract full points. Mathematical calculation is done to see if the house is left positive or negative. So that's just kind of a further understanding of what we were discussing earlier with that success or devastation of a house is the aspect of a benefic versus, or the occupation of the house by a benefic or with a sign is going to increase the success of that house versus the occupation or aspect of a malefic. The next part is something that we really haven't discussed much of. There's this idea of front rising or Shirshodaya houses, or Shirshodaya signs, that the houses that they're occupying are stronger than the individuals born during the day. Houses containing back rising or Krishnodaya signs are stronger when the person is born during the night. Signs with both rising, such as Gemini, are stronger during sunrise and sunset times. So that's the sunrise and sunset is that in between of night turning into day and day turning into night. So anyway, you don't have to memorize that. It's just something to kind of go, huh, about. Let's see. So for all of this, I think with Shatbala, just really pay attention to the Digbala, and also this idea on page 180 of angular strength. These are things that are very easy to see. The D part on page 180 of the Kendradi Bala, planets are stronger in angular houses. In general, benefics are better in angles as they give prosperity to the native. Malefic planets are better to be weak in Kendras and strong in Dustanas, while benefics are better strong in Kendras and weak in Dustanas. So there's this opposite. So like we've talked about malefics doing really well in the sixth house because of that quality of the person being able to fight their enemies. You don't necessarily want to see malefics in the Kendras because the Kendras are going to direct that person's life and they just make life experience harder for the person. So anyway, so looking at that and the angular strength and then looking at directional strength, the Digbala, those are the two things that I would really recommend paying attention to out of this section. Right, we're over time, but Freedom was suggesting doing some, is Caroline, is Freedom in the room?
He is coming.
did you have time to do Gemini strength rolls?
No, we haven't. We'll probably have to do that the next time.
Oh. All right. Oh my goodness, this is your chair to sit in. This is my client's chair, you know. they sit in. Let's see. So we're gonna do strength and destruction of a house. Alright, so give me a minute to open up a few charts. File. Open. And we got, let's see. Arjun, Bandhu. There we got Caroline. All right, and then we got Dan. What's your last name, Dan?
Wilkins.
It just says Greeley, Colorado?
Yes.
Okay. And Doug we won't do because he's not here today. I'll throw my chart up there. And let's throw... Jessica's not here.
My chart has some pretty good examples of houses being destroyed.
Everybody has. There's nobody that doesn't have some good houses destroyed. And Sarah, let's see. Sarah in here? Yes. All right, and well, Maritza's there, I didn't see, so didn't pull her chart up, but I think we have enough charts. All right, so we'll start with Sarah's, and let's see, and let's look at Sarah's career. Sound good? And houses prosper or and in the new edition I changed unsuccessful to struggle. Houses that struggle. I like that better than unsuccessful. Right? It's a little nicer. Because it's like it's struggle doesn't mean it's gonna be it doesn't mean it's dead, right? That there's some remedies possible. Who wants to take this on? You wanna go for it, Dan?
Okay.
And so before you start, I'm just going to give a little speech here. And so some people, you know, feel a little insecure when we share their chart and we talk about their chart. And sometimes people say, oh no, my world's going to end or whatever, whatever, you know. And I don't mean whatever, whatever, because, you know, it's serious. Yeah. But we use our own charts. And that's how my guru worked with me, is everybody in the room, that's whose charts were used. And we use our own charts because we're going to feel people talking about our stuff. And we're going to feel how comfortable or uncomfortable it feels. And when somebody says something and we don't like the way they say it, that's part of what we're learning. You know, by using our charts and having people talk about our charts and feeling what it feels like to have people just talk about our chart and say this or that, that allows us to say, oh, I never want to say that about someone's chart. Or if I see that, I'm going to say it this way. So there's one, that's one aspect of looking at our own, of using our charts. There's another aspect. Sometimes people don't like to share certain things of their life, and I get that. But and some people are like, oh, this part of my life is so bad, I don't want anybody to know. It's we all have good and bad aspects of our life, and sharing, and it's not sharing. Being
one part of Jyotish is to get that, hey, this is karma. It's like this part of my life, that's the karma. That's how it's meant to be. And I'm gonna work with it, I'm gonna do what I can with it, but this is how it's manifesting. And we're gonna just be okay with it, because by being okay with that, we're being okay with ourselves. And so part of just looking at our chart and saying, oh, that area is smashed. I mean, I can look at my chart and say, Venus is smashed. Oh, my first marriage was horrible. And, you know, I can sit there and be embarrassed that my first marriage was horrible. But, or I can just be like, hey, this is my karma. This is what was there. This is what I went through. You all get to learn from that. And I get to be me and get that's how this manifestation is. So there's a part of this where we're getting to be okay with who we are. And there's part of it where we're learning how to talk about these things, because they're sensitive areas. And you'll get people in your office where you just mention a certain thing and they'll break down in tears. And you got to give them a few minutes to cry, and you know, because you just touched on something that was really powerful for them. So talking about these charts and what goes on in them, it's also part of the teaching. So even though it's not explicitly part of the teaching, it's implicitly part of the teaching. All right. So that said, Dan, go ahead and let's talk about Sarah's 10th house.
Okay. It's occupied by Malefic, the Saturn.
That does what to it?
Destroys it.
Let's use struggle. We're going to use struggle.
Okay. Makes it unsuccessful.
Struggle. It makes it struggle. Okay. Yeah. Right? I like struggle. Terminology that we just had a lesson on how language impacts things, right? Struggle is a word that shows it's tough. It might not be working out, but it doesn't say that's forever, you know?
Right.
And there are ways and combinations that make things forever, but unless we know it's forever, we got to be very careful how we say it. Because if we say it in a way, if we say, oh, that's destroyed, do you inspire her to do anything to have a good career success?
Right.
You know, we say there's struggle there. Okay, there's struggle. I got to work hard. You know, there's a certain empowerment that happens with the word struggle. All right. So Saturn makes it struggle more.
Mm-hmm. Venus is giving it some nice light. Venus is particularly strong. It's aspecting the 10th house.
Okay.
Rahu is also aspecting the 10th house. And then the Lord, which is unpleasant. And then Mercury, the Lord of the 10th, is being afflicted by the Sun in K2. So there's some struggles.
So Sun in K2... And we do curses more in level 2, but they're both Agni Grahas.
Right.
But then there's also Rahu aspect. So Mercury's afflicted. It's under what we would call a curse, but I don't like to use the word curse when we're talking to clients. I say afflicted, because you tell somebody that their planet's cursed and they might you tell them it's afflicted and that there's ways to work with it, and it's much easier. They take it better. So the Lord is afflicted, and there's a malefic in the house. What else?
Let's see.
The Lord has gone to the third. What do you think that means? Good or bad? Does that make it stronger or weaker?
Third. I don't think it's particularly bad or good. I'm not sure.
Okay. And we'll go deeper into it when we get to Argala. But
okay.
Yeah. So what's your overall? Does she have an awesome career with lots of benefits and raises all the time, or is she struggling in the realm of career?
More struggles than benefits.
All right. So we're not going to get into remedies now. All we're doing is evaluating. So we see that's an area of her life where there's struggle.
Okay.
Let's go to the seventh house. And Dan, go ahead and do the seventh house real fast too, because it's the same vein.
Okay, so the seventh house, also lorded by Mercury. There's nothing in it. So similar situation. There's no benefics giving any drishti to it. It doesn't have that benefit to it, but it also is not being afflicted by Saturn. So there's a similar situation with the afflicted Mercury.
Similar, let's not say similar. Let's not say there's struggles there, but they're not the same. They're not as bad.
Okay.
If we had to say what area there's more struggle, there's definitely more struggle in the realm of career than there is in the realm of relationship.
Okay.
But relationship is not free of struggle.
Right.
Okay. And all right, let's go and we're going to do Parvati's chart, and we'll have Sarah look at Parvati's chart.
But freedom on the previous chart we just did, which I believe was Sarah's, Saturn is aspecting the seventh house with its tenth house aspect. So it is aspected also by a malefic.
It's aspected, but the bottom line is it's not as bad as the tenth.
Okay.
And that's it's not, the tenth house is struggling more with the planet placed there. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see. Are you still with us, Sarah?
I'm here.
All right.
I'm not very savvy yet, so honestly, I'm looking. What house do you want me to look at?
Let's go for her 10th house first.
And okay, so her 10th house is ruled by, is that a 9?
Yep.
Sag, which is ruled by, the house lord is Jupiter. There's no planets there, so Jupiter's moved to the fourth house.
Fourth.
Seventh, thank you. Seventh.
Is seventh good or bad? Seventh good or bad?
Well, it's... isn't that relative? No, it's good. It's the house of marriage and relationship.
It's a Kendra. That's what makes it good.
Kendra, yeah.
It's a Kendra or a trine. Okay. So for that, the tenth lord has gone to a good house.
Okay.
Okay.
And so then where do I even go from there?
Aspect it or aspect it by benefics or malefics.
Okay. Well, I'm not there yet. I can't even tell where it's aspecting.
All right. So you want to, in the next 3 weeks, you want to make sure you get that down, okay? While we're doing the review in the next 3 weeks. And we don't, and anybody want to please ring in? Benefics or malefics aspecting?
The Lord went to the 10th from it, so that's another.
That's good, but any aspects? Mm-hmm.
Conjunct moon,
but any aspects?
No.
No graha aspects. All right. And so we just said that there. So there's no benefic or malefic aspects. That's not changing anything. It's not, and that means it's not aspected by its own lord. The lord has gone to a good house, and then our next thing is when the Lord is in a good or bad avasta. Is it in a good or bad avasta?
It's good.
It's good. Why is it good?
It's with the moon in the seventh house.
Avasta is just, it's with the moon. It's conjunct the benefic. So it's conjunct the benefic, so it's in a good avasta. So it's enjoying hanging out with good people. So what's the end result of her 10th house? Do we have struggles or success in the realm of career?
Success.
So we have success in the realm of career. All right. Let's do... All right. Who's going to do my chart? We'll have Caroline do my chart.
No.
So, we have... you want to do career? You want to do... do relationship and then do home.
Okay. So, the lord of the seventh house is Jupiter, which goes to the 12th. So, that can cause some struggles going into a Dustana house. And then, there's nothing in it, but as far as aspects... my aspects off the top of my head from what I'm...
next 3 weeks, okay. You guys got to get the aspects good.
Okay, so what else? Okay, so it goes from fifth from
so
it.
There's no aspects.
So no aspects.
Yeah.
So
as Lord has gone to a bad house, there's right. No positive or negative aspects, no planets there. Yeah. What about the Avasta?
The Avasta, well, it's in the 12th house, but it's not conjunct anything.
Does it like being in Venus's house?
Yeah.
Yeah?
So, I mean, I don't know. I don't think it's particularly...
Anybody weigh in? Does it like being in Venus's house?
No.
and the lord of it has gone to, and the lord of that house has gone to the sixth house from it, which makes it a neutral or a great enemy?
Great enemy.
Neutral.
Great enemy.
Oh. Neutral?
Yeah.
But if it's an enemy, oh.
What is it? Or hold on, am I?
No, it is a great enemy.
A great enemy. Yeah, so it makes it a great enemy.
So there's definitely struggles in the relationship realm. But it could be worse because there's no house.
It could totally be worse. But and that's why I like the word struggle. Right? Like, it's hard to say it's very unsuccessful or it's a little unsuccessful. That doesn't make sense, does it? Nah, but a little struggle versus a lot of struggle, that makes more sense, mm-hmm. You know? So that's why I've in the future version, that's changed to struggle. When we look at an enemy sign makes it unhappy, right? Mm-hmm. So it's unhappy and it's not in a good, it's not well placed, so there's definitely struggle there. It could be totally a lot worse, but it's not good. What about the fourth house?
Fourth house. Okay, so the fourth house contains a benefic and a malefic, but the sun is not one of the greatest malefic or like largest enemy malefic planets. So, but the Mercury's in Virgo, which it's exalted, so that makes it much stronger.
Uh-huh, so the lord of it's exalted in its own sign.
So it's less struggle there because of that. Aspects, well, Jupiter is...
There's a Jupiter aspect, yep. Mm-hmm. And one more.
Saturn aspect.
Yeah.
So
pluses, there's a bunch of pluses and minuses, but mm-hmm. What wins out?
The Mercury being exalted.
And in its own house.
In its own house.
So there's a lot of success there. Mm-hmm. A little, there's going to be some struggles. Mm-hmm. We got that Saturn aspect. We got a malefic there, mm-hmm. but we're going to have a lot of success in that realm. Not mm-hmm. without struggle. It's not going to be like successes and never a problem.
Right.
You know, my first house, I bought when the market was really high, in the Bay Area, and they just gave me a loan. I came back from India, and the first place I went to get a loan, they said, how much have you been paying in rent? And I said, I don't pay rent. I lived in India for the last 6 years. And they laughed at me. The next place, same. They laughed at me. The third place, I said, I've been living in India the last few years. And the woman said, really? Do you know about Puttaparthi? Which is where Sai Baba lives. And I have friends that have a house mm-hmm. in Puttaparthi. And so I started telling her some of the stories that they said, and she was drooling. Mm-hmm. She said, here, just have a friend sign this, and if they call, say you paid $2,800 a month in rent. And she gave it to me. She added a few zeros onto my bank account, put the thing through, I had a loan. I was like, wow. That mantra Guruji gave me worked. But then the whole housing market tanked, and luckily there was some equity. I took the equity out, bought my house in Nevada City, and then had to short sell that house. So there's a Saturn, you know, aspect, kind of giving its power. But like there's that exalted planet giving all this benefit. So we mm-hmm. see that there's both success and, but not without struggle.
All right, good job. Let's see. And let's see. So we got Dan's chart now. And we'll have Perul do Dan's chart.
Okay.
Let's look at his career, let's look at his home karma too.
Okay. So there's nothing in the house of career or the house of home. Career is in the sign of Aries, which is lorded by Mars.
Mars is Aries lorded by Mars, so which house is it going to?
And it's in the fifth from the tenth.
Fifth from, but where from Lagna first?
Okay, from Lagna, second from Lagna.
And is that positive or negative?
Mars with the sun.
No, in the second house, is that a positive or a negative house?
It's positive.
It's a neutral. That's a trick question.
I mean, it's not a bad house.
It's not good. Bad is not good. It's a neutral house.
Okay. So it's not good or bad. Let's see. Is Saturn aspect in it now? Jupiter aspect in it? No. Is Mars aspect in it? No. So it's I don't know what to say.
You missed one planet. You missed one planet.
Rahu?
Uh-huh.
Oh. Yeah, Rahu's aspecting it. Okay.
All right. So we got a malefic aspect with no benefic aspecting.
No benefic aspect, but both Lord and Rahu are 5 and 9 from it, so it's probably helping that house in some way.
Yeah, well, we're not going to look at 5 and 9 from it. We're just looking at Rahu who has an aspect. The Lord has gone to a neutral house from it, so the Lord from it's not lifting. It's creating a relatively neutral plane, but we have a Rahu aspect. So overall, are we successful? Are we struggling?
Maybe only slightly struggling.
We didn't do Avasta. We didn't do Avasta. One more thing, okay. Avasta. Right, what's the Avasta of the Lord?
The Avasta of Mars.
Uh-huh.
It's with a benefic.
Uh-huh, which makes it...
It's what makes it positive, which makes it comfortable, or hold on, with a benefic, it makes it not bad, I should say. I don't know exactly the term.
We don't want to use the term not bad.
So it's delighted.
It's delighted. It's happy.
It's happy. Yeah, and it's in that, in that, in the sign of a friend. So it's, yeah, it's okay. It's happy. It's content. It's in the sign of a friend.
Not just content. It's happy. Happy is very different than content, right? Mm-hmm. It's one thing to be content. It's another thing to be happy and enjoy what you're doing.
It's happy.
All right. So put all that together into an interpretation of his 10th house career.
So generally he enjoys what he does. Sometimes maybe with the Rahu aspect, he might have some like delusions, or he might encounter some delusional experiences.
Just struggles. There's some struggles there.
Sorry. Okay.
Yep. Because that struggle can be somebody stealing his job from him, you know? So it's not just his internal, it can also be external. Mm. So there's going to be some struggles there.
Okay.
So you see how we put all them together? It's not like one ran out or the other, they're all coming together. He has an enjoyable career, he enjoys what he's doing. There's some struggles occasionally, particularly in Rahu Dashas and bad transits, there'll be some struggles. But otherwise, he's happy with what he does. Mm-hmm.
And when Rahu aspect indicate that maybe like just, I mean, this is just coming to my mind, that maybe sometimes people promise him things that he gets excited about, like work-wise, and then they don't necessarily come through, or he gets disappointed because Rahu sort of casts that illusion.
Rahu's aspecting from the sixth house. That's going to be competition and people speaking behind his back to get his job, and it's... Okay. That's Rahu in the sixth house is his need to have to fight an enemy force.
Right.
And it's not associated with the moon, so we're not gonna bring it into his head and mental space.
I see that. Okay.
So you get like I'm gonna be interpreting that aspect based upon the nature of what is aspecting and what's going on with that.
Cool.
Yeah. So you see how much we just understood just by that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, you guys get that all this stuff you're memorizing, like, it can say so much about life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna, just because time's ticking, let's jump over. And so Amritavidya, you haven't read one yet. And has anybody else not read? Oh, Ravi. Are you there, Ravi? I can't see you. I don't know if they're still with us. Amrita, this is Caroline's chart up here right now, right? That's your chart?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's do her career. And... yeah, and depending how fast that goes, we'll do a little more. Oh, there's Ravi. All right. So Ravi, you're next. Or let me go over here. We're gonna pull out Ravi's chart. It's not in there. Oh no, it's not in there. Ravi, what's your first name again in the file? It's... Oh. Ravi. What do I
have? He's got some internet problems.
Oh, some internet. So you're not... We don't hear you. Does Pooja's mic work? No? All right. So make sure you practice this so you get this. Like, one of the reasons that we do this is to make sure that everybody is... Because when you do it, then you get to see what you understand and what you don't understand. So make sure you practice this on one or two charts. If there's any doubt... Ask me and get that mic working so next week we can double check and make sure it's all working for you. All right, so Amrita, go ahead and do Caroline's chart.
Okay.
Let's do 10th house. And what, you want relationship or home?
It doesn't matter.
Which one, relationship or home?
Relationship.
Relationship. So let's do career and relationship.
So 10th house is, it has Venus and Rahu in it. Venus is neutral to Aries and Aries.
So when we look in the house, our first thing to look at is benefic, malefic.
Okay, so one benefic and one malefic.
All right, so we have some struggle, we have some struggle, we have some success. That's where we're going with this. Now whether Venus is friendly or how strong or not, that shows how much the success is going to be. But bottom line is that Venus is putting us onto the success side. Okay.
Right.
And then from there, jump to the Lord.
Okay, and Mars, Lord Mars is in Sag.
Just straight. It's mm-hmm. Is it in a benefic? Is it in a Kendra trine or is it in a Dushtana?
No, it's in a Dushtana.
Okay, so we got a negative there. It's in a Dushtana. Now, positive or negative? That, like, when we look at, like, okay, is it friendly with Sagittarius or not? That's going to show us how much of a struggle or not a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
First, we need to know, if that had gone to the fifth house, we'd say, oh, it's going to be success. How much success? But it's in a Dushtana, so it's how much struggle. You got the difference? So before we even go into what it's in, let's look at, like, what is it giving us? So we got a benefic and a malefic. So we got some success, we got some struggle. We got the Lord giving us some struggle. Now let's go into the Avasta of that Lord.
So it's friends with Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
And Jupiter is third from it, so it's a great friend.
Great. So it's in a good Avasta. So even though it's a bad place, it's not as there could be a lot of struggle, but it's not that much struggle. Right?
Yeah.
All right. What about aspects?
I'm not seeing any aspects.
All right. And so now there's one for what makes a house struggle. We talk about if the Lord is destroyed or conjunct malefics, if not aspected by its own Lord, or in combination with Dushtana Lords. Is it in combination with the Dushtana Lord?
Mm-hmm.
That house.
Mars?
No, the house.
The house is, Rahu. Yeah, actually Rahu is eighth lord.
Exactly. So not only is it a malefic, but it's a malefic who's lording a Dushtana. So there's two ticks right there on struggle. So it's not one struggle that Rahu's bringing two struggles. All right. So what would be your end interpretation here?
I think overall it does pretty well because of just having Venus and Mars is in a good Avasta. It's going to have some struggles, but generally does well.
All right. So I would say there's struggles, but it overcomes. Because there is more struggle than there is. There's more negatives. There's more house destroying than there are house successing. Right?
Mm-hmm. I was thinking kind of even.
Yeah, let's see. So we got Rahu that gives us two on the struggle,
Venus that gives us one on the positive. Mm-hmm. Mars in Adushtana gives us another struggle. It's a good Avasta, so that gives us a benefit. So it's three struggle, two benefit.
Right.
So we can straight count just like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're talking about struggle. Right. There's a lot of struggle, but she overcomes. As long as we make that Venus strong. We gotta make that Venus strong.
I've seen a lot of them.
Yeah. There's always worse. Trust me, there's always worse. You know? All right, and then let's do relationship.
Okay, she has Moon in Capricorn. And I don't see any ass. Oh, it has a third house aspect from Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
Moon is friends with Saturn, I believe. But Saturn is not so nice to Moon, but Moon is nice to everybody. How does that work?
Moon's neutral there.
Okay. Moon's neutral. And it has that third house.
But Saturn is in a temporary friend place. So it ends up being a friend.
It's right. It's a 11th house from the house. So yeah, it's a friend.
Mm-hmm.
But Saturn is also aspecting from the third house aspect.
Yep.
And so.
But the Saturn's the Lord, so
go to the Lord.
Yeah.
Right. He's the Lord, so he doesn't hurt as much.
No, he's not going to hurt the house. He'll hurt the moon, but he won't hurt the house.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so he's going to hurt the moon, her mind. There's, you know, when I say he's hurts the house, but not the he hurts the planet, but not the house. So that means, you know, Saturn aspecting the moon, that gives lots of worries and anxieties, right? So she's going to have worries and anxieties from Saturn aspecting that, but Saturn's going to make her relationship karma strong. Saturn's going to make her really tough in the realm of relationship and make sure that she is getting into relationships that she wants to and making them happen the way she wants to.
Right.
Going in the order that they're listed by Parashara. This list right here is straight from Parashara. I'd add a few things to it if I could, but I'm not adding anything to it just because it's straight from Parashara. So based on that, you missed one something.
Saturn is not. I think it's enemies with Mars. So it's in Mars' house.
Yeah, but more important, it's in the fifth house.
Right. But I thought I said that. It's in a good Avasta.
Okay, well, not a good Avasta. It's in a good placement. It's in a good placement.
It's a good placement.
Avasta,
I said that.
Avasta is because it's in Scorpio. Where it is from Lugna is whether it's in a good house or not.
Right.
Okay.
So it's in a good house, but it's not as good Avasta because Well, it's neutral because Mars is second house from it, so it becomes neutral.
Perfect. So add up our things. What do we got? Of struggle and success.
Yeah. It's a mix, but
no mix. You just go straight by the books. Straight. You know, like I listened to this lecture the other day, and it was I was almost like, oh my gosh, I can't believe people are listening to this. The guy's sitting there going, And K2, his exaltation and debilitation, it's so hard to understand. It's so confusing. Nobody can understand it. It's just, you can't understand how it works. And I'm like, what are you giving a lecture for saying you can't understand it? I mean, there's rules. We just follow the rules. Okay. So don't sit there and you know, like right, occupied by benefics or malefics. What are we getting?
Yeah, it's got a benefic.
Benefic. So we got one point there.
Wow.
Aspect it by its own lord. Yes or no?
Uh-huh.
So we got another one on the plus side. Or the lord of the house. It's lord in a good or bad house?
It's in a good house.
Another one on the plus side. Then what do we got? Uh-huh. And then it's lord in a good or bad Avasta?
Neutral Avasta.
Neutral, so it's not going to either side. So what are we getting for the realm of relationship? Yeah.
Good.
It's good.
It's good.
So that's we don't need to be confused. We don't need to guess. We just follow. This is the list Parashar gives. We just go down it, right? And then there's no issues. It's, you know, like we only get confused and say no one can understand when we're not. I mean, the rules are there. We just literally follow them and it's good. So she there's relationship success in her life. We can say that, you know, and I won't go into the fact that Rahu is conjunct Venus, which gives some certain qualities to the relationship realm. But overall, she has a successful relationship life. All right, everybody get it? Right, we just follow the rules, we read them down, it's plus or minus. Is there success or struggle here? So there's lots of success in the realm of relationship. Sometimes it's good or bad, but she chooses, she makes her concepts there. In the end, you know, we give a little remedy for relationship and it'll give good results very easily.
I'm a little confused why Saturn's in a good Avasta in this situation.
He's neutral. He's not good.
Oh, neutral. Why is it neutral?
Enemy sign, but the Lord, natural enemy, temporal friend.
Oh, okay, got it.
Yeah. So the Avasta is neutral, which. I mean, the thing, if other things weren't good, we would say, it makes her kind of bored in relationships and they're not really doing too much for her. You know, it's, but we got the moon there. So the moon there makes it, how can we say, the moon spices things up. Or the moon makes things juicy. You know, the moon brings that juice. So even if the partner does have this little Rahu thing, there's lots of, you know, passion and desires and fulfillments and all that with Moon in the seventh as a benefit. Mm-hmm. All right. Is everybody getting how this prosperity or struggle? I got to change the title too. It can't be destruction of the house. Prosperity or struggle of a house? What's the opposite of struggle? I should say success or struggle of a house. That would be better. Right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we just followed the rules. When we follow the rules, it's simple. There's no confusion. You know, it's there. We add them up. And like in Perul's case, we had a beautiful way where we could interpret them together. In other cases, they're leaning more towards struggle. In other cases, they're leaning more towards success. You know, and we just know some areas of life have more struggle, some areas have more success. That's going to let us know where we need to do remedies. Do we need to do a remedy for Caroline's relationship? No, we just need to give her some good advice. Stay away from smelly hippies. Go for successful men. You got good karma there. There's no... You know? Where now, with Sarah and her career, do we got to give some remedies? We have to give remedies there. You know what I mean? Naturally, there's more struggle. So that's somewhere where we need to work. And if we look at everybody's chart, I've never found a chart where there's no struggle. It doesn't exist. There's always somewhere, some area that the person is struggling. All right. So you guys, what? You got off next week? You're having just a review next time. Review these aspects. You see how important they are?
Yeah.
And you see how important the Avastas are? Mm-hmm. All right. Now, and as we move on forward from here, just how we were just what we were doing just now, that's how class gets to be. All this stuff that you're memorizing, we're using it to start interpreting and to start understanding a person's life. So if you don't know your aspects, it's going to be like, all of a sudden you can't see what's going on there. So everything that we've learned so far, we got to get in there. That way we can use it. And it's tough just memorizing it, but literally once we get into the next half of the book and we're using it all the time, then it's just there. You know what I mean? Because when you use something, then it stays with you. But we got to get it in there to be able to use it. All right. Anything to... What's your plan on the 26th, on the 27th, Ian?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
So, 27th, I'm actually moving. I was thinking next week we should do the Gemini strength rules. And then we can start on the 27th, that period of time.
Go ahead and review everything. Wait till I'm back for the Gemini strength rules, just so I can make sure to clear everything up if there's a bigger issue.
Okay, great. So so shall we review on the 20th then?
Well, since you're moving on the 27th, you might, right?
Is that next week?
That's next week. Or do you guys want to go for, what is it? Is May 4th an off week too? Is that what we decided, or?
I don't know what we ultimately decided, actually.
I think
I was waiting to hear your orders.
I think we were going to do 20th and 4th off and just a study group on the 27th and start class again on the 11th.
Okay.
Yeah. So what I want is for you guys to be in touch with each other and spend an hour on the phone with each other just quizzing. That way you're not all by yourself memorizing this stuff. Like, you know, have a friend. That way it makes it a little less boring.
Yeah, it's just a little unclear. When are we meeting? The 27th or the
20th? Ian?
I'm saying the 20th.
All right.
So we'll have the 27th and the 4th off.
Can we, after next week, can we still email both you?
Yeah. All emails. Yeah. Okay. We're having off class so that you can review and study instead of learning something new. That's what the off is. The off is not to give us a break.
Okay.
The off is to give you a break. All right. So Ian, you'll email people and let them and clear that up. And
yes.
And as I said, like, buddy up.